supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, burning bush is a very common and beautiful landscape plant. What can you do if you bought the dwarf variety and it's getting taller than your house? We'll answer that question and discuss the burning bush of the Bible. We think we know what plant that was. We're also going to talk about entering a plant in your local flower show and what it takes. That's a lot to get done. We better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How are you today?
I'm good, Bob. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
And where is Bob doing well?
The Shattuck Station, New Jersey.
Okay, what can we do for Bob?
So I have a set of three Norway spruce trees, mature Norway spruce trees, about 15 feet tall. This was the second set that was put in this spot on my property about 10, 12 years ago. The first set died off. Two of the three that are there now, again, mature, all of a sudden about 10 months ago, started to brown out, and within a week's time, were completely dead and completely brown. Only two of the three. The third one is still looking very healthy and very much alive. So I was wondering what it could be. Do I need to see it, bring in an arborist? What do you think could be going on?
The first thing you want to do is rule out a disease known as needle cast. This is a disease that affects these trees. It starts out as the individual needles yellowing, but it can run through a tree really quickly once it gets started, especially if the tree isn't in the optimum condition.
On my property, there are two other areas fairly far away that also have groupings of three. And those trees, Norway spruce, are about 20 to 25 years old and doing well, thriving.
Okay.
So this is the other side of the property.
So is the area where the trees are not doing well wet? Does it drain poorly? Does water stand there after rains?
Well, there's a swell that takes the water away as it rains. And they were planted higher, if you will, relative to the ground than the last time. So I can't say that there's no standing water, but it does drain off.
I've had experience with both extremes here. When people plant trees up on what they call berms, these raised areas, one thing they don't take into account is that area dries out 100 times faster than the surrounding soil. So there may be water down low, but I lost one of these trees in Superstorm Sandy, and I was amazed at how shallow the root system was, even though it was an enormous, monstrous 80-foot tree. The other possibility is if this area is poor draining and does retain a lot of water, this would not be any kind of a good tree for that area. There are trees that can survive a high water table and poor drainage, but they are a short handful. And of course, the one biggest class, the willows, have very invasive roots. The one that comes to mind that does well in situations like this is the river birch. Now, the only other thing I can think of, are they growing in or near a lawn?
Yes.
Is the lawn treated?
Not necessarily, no. Some lime, but I haven't fertilized in a number of years now.
Okay, but no herbicides?
No.
Okay, so there's three possibilities. One is the needle cast disease, and you can call your local extension office. They may ask you to mail them samples or send photographs of the needles on the dead trees, but they can confirm whether or not it's needle cast. And you can also look online, now that you know the name of the disease, and see if the symptoms correspond to that. My gut instinct is telling me that this area either dries out where the root system is or stays too wet. And you're the best judge of that. I mean, to go out in the area, if you can find an area where the roots aren't, and during a normal time of year, dig a little hole with a shovel and pour a bucket of water in it. And if that water is still standing there after a couple of hours and hasn't drained off, then, you know, that's a killer spot for trees. And I would urge you to look at the difference between the cluster of trees that's healthy and yours. I got to think that those trees are growing in good flat ground that drains well. And if I had to put a bet down on the table, I would bet that your trees are in waterlogged soil.
Okay. All right. Well, the needle cap is something to consider, and then the drainage as well. So it's just puzzling that such mature trees would die off so rapidly.
A lot of big trees are dying off. You know, conditions are just changing so rapidly. It's a bad time for established trees right now, unfortunately.
Yeah, gosh.
Work with your local extension office, and good luck. I hope the last one stays alive for you.
Thanks so much, Mike.
All right.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Luis, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. I'm in Lafayette, Louisiana.
Excellent.
The happiest city in the United States.
How far are you from New Orleans?
About an hour and a half.
Okay. What can we do for Luis in Louisiana?
Well, Mike, two things. First, I got a nice pear tree, a Bartlett. It's about 20 feet tall. It's about 9 years old or 8 years old. And it has only produced one pear once. All the limbs go straight up. And so I bought another pear tree about 3 years ago to pollinate as recommended. It has not happened. In addition to that, my peach tree is full of flowers. And some of my azaleas are also beginning to flower. And I'm just wondering how confused the weather is out here.
And your peach trees, have they been productive for you?
Yes, in the past, though, they have some problems because of the weather. You know, I get a little bit of the rot, and I get the gum that comes out of them sometimes.
Oh, yeah. No, peach trees are like the hardest thing you can grow, Lou. And down where you are, you have three times as many pests and diseases in the deep south as I do here. But at least the tree is producing fruit, unlike the pears.
It is. It's just that I don't know. We haven't had but one cold day so far this year, 36 degrees.
Right.
And now today is like 80s.
Oh.
You know, so very, very confusing.
So are you worried about the number of chilling hours it's going to get, or is it in flower?
It's in flower, but I think that, you know, come the end of January, beginning of February, we're going to get some freezing days. And I was just wondering what's going to happen.
Well, there's really nothing you can do except to try to moderate the temperature when you do drop down to freezing. If you get a really cold night that's also really still, you might want to have, I mean, professionals have little smudge pots, smoke pots going at the base of their trees.
Uh-huh.
But what I tell regular homeowners to do is hang some Christmas lights, some old Christmas lights, the ones that get hot, up in the branches of the tree and leave them on overnight any nights that are going to be really below freezing and very still. If there's a good breeze blowing, you don't need to do anything.
Okay.
Now, as to how old are your pear trees?
My pear tree is probably about 8 or 9 years old.
And the Bartlett, you've never had any fruit on it?
One time, one pear, could tell.
And what was the variety you planted to pollinate it?
I'm trying to remember. It's what is recommended by the Agricultural Service. It's got a very strange name. It's not the kind of fruit that you will find in the supermarket, but I can't remember right now.
There is a famous bad combination. There's a pear called the Seckle, and that variety does not cross-pollinate with Bartlett. How many years have you had the second tree there?
The second tree is probably about 4 years old.
Okay, good. And they do both flower?
Very little.
One of the things that comes to mind is, do you get enough chilling hours? These kind of fruits, unfortunately, they grow better up where I live because they have what's called a chilling requirement, a certain number of hours in the hundreds, where the temperature has to be below like 40 degrees. And
okay, that might be one of the problems.
Yeah. So what I would do before you invest a lot more time in it, I would talk to my local agricultural extension office and see if you have enough chilling hours to successfully grow pears, and if maybe to do so you need a very specific variety. Those are called low chill fruits. They can get by with like 100 hours, whereby, for instance, the peach trees I grow need like many hundreds of hours. Again, below 40. So it's not just below freezing. But then with your peach tree that's already flowered, the nights you want to worry about it are below 30 and no wind. That's when you want to cover it with a blanket or put lights up in it or put a smudge pot down at the base.
Okay, well, I appreciate that.
All right, good luck, Lewis.
Thank you, Mike. It's good talking to you. Have a great day.
You too. Take care. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will deliver two workshops at the NOFA New Jersey Conference on Saturday and Sunday, January 30th and 31st, at Brookdale Community College in Lincroft, New Jersey. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with flower show tips, burning bushes, and more of your burning phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, coming up later in the show, all about the burning bush. We're going to talk about the popular bright red in the fall landscape plant. We're going to discuss what dwarf really means to that landscape plant. We're even going to talk about the plant that experts seem to think may have been the burning bush of the Bible. And we're going to take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it is time to bring on our guest, Diane Newberry, who has served as the co-chair of the Hamilton Horticourt at the famed Philadelphia Flower Show, put on by the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society. And she's here to talk to us about what it takes to enter a plant in the world's biggest and greatest indoor flower show. Diane Newberry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being had. Obviously, we want this to apply to everybody around the country who wants to do something spectacular. You don't have to enter a plant in the flower show to want it to look great in March. But I have to admit, I've won 4 Best of Shows from major exhibits in the past when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, and have always been more impressed by the plants that the so-called amateurs bring in for the flower show. I mean, one single plant in this horticourt, I mean, sometimes would blow away an entire display.
Right. Well, I think you're right to be impressed, because it is an amazing show with an amazing variety of plants, rare, unusual, and some of them are grown on people's windowsills. It's not just big exhibitors with big greenhouses.
And it's not just you get to take a perfect picture of your plant on its best day of a year. You have to time this thing to be around the first, second week of March. And you also have to get it from wherever you are into the convention center in what is typically winter's last icy grasp, trying to pluck success out of your hands.
That's right. We have exhibitors who rent trucks, vans. They have setups in their car that they can safely bring their plants to the convention center. They've got all sorts of contraptions, wagons, carts to get them up to the floor. It really is quite a feat for many of them.
You've run this gigantic show of homegrown plants. What are some of your favorites or the ones that you would perhaps suggest for someone to start with?
Well, I think there are a lot of foliage plants that are good that can be grown on a windowsill. I think some pelargoniums are one that I think are easily grown in the house if you don't have a greenhouse.
We don't want leaves, Diane.
Ah, but there are variegated leaves.
I'm glad you like your variegated leaves, but I want something that's really going to rescue me from the depths of March. For instance, these perfect little pots of spring bulbs, mm-hmm. whether they're tulips or daffodils or crocus, you're looking at one perfect pot that you're going, oh my goodness, how did they do this? How many pots are at home that bloomed too early or are blooming too late?
Well, that's usually people who do bulb forcing have many, many pots that they have in their, you know, stashed in sort of the window wells of their basement or, you know, a little hidden place that they put their plants, and they have to take them out at just the right time to get them, to bring them into the warmth, to get them to bloom, to get them to get tall enough, and to be, of course, perfect, even. It's hard. It's really hard. And yes, there are many that are left at home that didn't quite make the cut. So that's one of the hardest things from my point of view anyway.
When you would be co-chair, you're taking a break right now, but you've done it in the past.
Mm-hmm.
When you bring a plant into the flower show, how many days do you get to show it off?
Well, there are 3 judging days throughout the flower show, and the whole horticourt really flips all those 3 judging days. And you can keep your plant in for the entire week and flip it into different classes or keep it within the same class. It's possible. You have to judge that when you go, and each judging morning go and figure out whether you need to re-enter it or whether it's show quality anymore. So that's the other thing. I don't think a lot of people realize that the entire horticourt changes 3 different times the course.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really incredible.
When we had major exhibits in the flower show, on the last day of the flower show, there was not a single live plant in our exhibit that had been there on day one.
Right. You have to keep freshening up. And exactly.
I mean, I have been struck by a plant from maybe 100 feet away that I've had to go up and look at. And it got like 3rd place. And I think, this is like when I was trying to get a date back in high school. I mean, what do you got to do?
I know. Some people do want to ask that. Well, sometimes a plant, the one that wins a blue ribbon, is incredibly rare. It could be, you know, a very mature specimen that the judge knows takes a great deal of talent and perseverance to get there. And sometimes
blind luck.
And then sometimes blind luck. Yes, indeed.
The Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, the people who sponsored the flower show for, we're getting close to 200 years now. They actually run classes over the winter for people who want to enter this horse race.
Yes, because you have until January 31st to enter your plants, and you can do it online or by mail. And you can enter, you know, what I usually do anyway, I have entered. I haven't done it in the last couple of years, but I usually look at all my plants and take the exhibitor's guide and figure out what I think will look good, and I enter everything. And you don't have to take it if it doesn't look good. So that's certainly what I would counsel someone to do. Enter everything they think could possibly be good in the beginning of March, and then bring what looks good.
You're saying a guy like me can register plants in January and say, I'm going to do this. And then if I show up with something ragged, what happens? Are there people there to, you know, escort me off the property, or, you know, they have crying towels?
We have passers. And when you bring your plant in, you bring the cards that you've written up. You have cards that you bring with your plant. And a plant expert will take a look at it and make sure it's free of pests and disease and that it's in show condition, which means, you know, prune properly, dead leaves gone, nice top dressing on the top of your pot. You've seen them all. You know how perfect they look.
Yeah, and one thing that it occurs to me now, how important is the pot?
Well, you really get points for the whole presentation, which means a clean pot, no chips. The other thing, too, is that if you're a new exhibitor or a novice exhibitor, which means you haven't won a blue ribbon, there are classes every single judging day for a first-time exhibitor. It's called Beginner's Luck. So if you're new to the flower show but really want to try it and see what it's like, I would really recommend bringing your plant and entering it in that class.
So start out with plants with wonderful leaves, variegated leaves. Because, again, I mean, we're talking about naturally low-light conditions over the winter.
There are so many great foliage plants that don't require, you know, full sunlight. And
I tell people who want to grow canna lilies and they don't have enough sun to make them flower, I say, grow them for the leaves.
Yeah, you're gonna love in a garden, they're gorgeous. There's the structure. Yes.
Now, In your experience, when the years you've been chair, I know there's organizations like the Men's Garden Club of Philadelphia that, you know, if it was a guy, a real guy, he'd be 125 years old. But does anybody come to mind who's just been entering prize-winning plants for like 27, 35 years?
The Succulent and Cactus Society is quite strong, and they have some amazing growers, and they are always looking for unusual plants to bring to the flower show. And many of them own hundreds of plants, probably.
There are plants in that category at the flower show that I've not seen anywhere else, that even my plant book doesn't have a picture of.
That's right. They search out these plants. I don't even know where they find them, but they are constantly looking for unusual things and rare things. And they're, I think, back and forth across the country, some of these plants are traveling.
What's the most unusual plants you've seen there over the years? What actually surprised you? You know, like, I didn't know you could put this in a pot.
Well, I guess one of the things I love, which, because I know it's very difficult to do, are any of the forest snowdrops, Galanthus.
Right, because they're done outside.
Well, not by March. March is usually the month here in Philadelphia that you'll see them outside. But to get them to bloom at the beginning of March is quite a feat. It's really difficult.
Because they're the very definition of ephemeral, right?
Oh, yeah, I think so.
They only open for a day or two.
And they're just so beautiful. They're beautiful when they're massed in the garden, and to see them in a little pot is just, oh, you know, that to me is the essence of spring, springtime coming anyway.
And that's what not only our flower show, but flower shows around the country are all about. Hang on, gardeners.
It's almost time to get your hands dirty. Right.
All right. Well, this year's Philadelphia Flower Show, which celebrates the national parks. And I made an offhand comment to somebody who works for the flower show, and they went, "Oh yeah, we'll have geysers." You know, of course we will. It's Philadelphia. This year's flower show will be held from March 5th to the 13th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center in downtown Philadelphia. Diane Newberry will not be co-chair of horticulture in the Hamilton Horticourt, but she'll be hanging around there looking at all those beautiful plants. All right, Diane Newberry, thanks so much for being on You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks for having me.
And now back to your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Craig, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike.
Hello.
Glad to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you here, Craig. Where are you, man?
Avalon, New Jersey.
Oh, the famous New Jersey down the shore beach resort that is, quote, cooler by a mile.
One and the same.
All right. What can we do for Craig in Avalon?
In our dunes, we have Japanese black pine. And the Japanese black pine here have been dying. We have had problems with black turpentine beetle, pinewood nematode, and blue stain fungus. And what we were hoping was that we could use the newer forms of BT, one of them, on these trees to try and save them. They appear to be getting infected at a real high rate, and they die within 3 months of the infestation starting.
Okay, so these things are actually planted in the dunes close to the ocean?
Yes.
Okay. In general, that kind of a situation for a black pine would seem to be okay. But are they salt tolerant? Are they good with the winds off the ocean and everything like that?
That I don't know. They were planted years ago because they were known to thrive in those situations, but they have done very poorly in our dunes.
But they've been there a long time.
Yes.
And they're just starting to go now.
Yes.
So the one beetle, the bark-eating beetle, the turpentine beetle, that's something that you've obviously, you've seen the borer holes and everything like that?
Yes.
And how do you know that you have these nematodes, these nasty nematodes?
The nematodes, I'm assuming, are also at work because of what's happening to the black pines. I know that they can affect them. Them, we haven't seen. We have seen the turpentine beetles.
And have any of the pines died completely and been removed?
Yes.
Okay.
Many of them.
And I presume these are root nematodes that would attack the root system of the plant.
Yes.
And did you see the signs of nematode feeding on the roots of the dead one?
No.
Now, see, I don't know. You know, here in the Northeast, there aren't a lot of pest nematodes. There's one that attacks boxwoods, and that's the only one I know of. The root knot nematodes are a bigger problem down south. Again, what leads you to believe that that's the pest?
Well, I think that the main pest that we have is the borer.
Okay, the new BT is called BTG, BT Galleria, and was mostly developed to fight Japanese beetles, but it was discovered that it has a wide range of ability to work on a number of different beetles, including the emerald ash borer. And again, right now, the only place that a consumer can get this is from Gardens Alive. They have the exclusive on it for the first couple of years. So you might want to go to their website and look it up. I think they call it Beetlejuice. Look for Japanese beetle controls, go to Beetlejuice, and then there will be a list of the EPA-approved insects. And so you want to at least find that it's effective against something like this. I've been on a lot of beaches lately. I've seen a lot of dune restoration work going on. You're certainly welcome to try the BTG. You're not going to harm anything other than these beetles. But you might have to inject it into the trunk. One of the reasons the BTG is effective against the emerald ash borer is you can spray it on the leaves. And the borers, when they first emerge in their adult form, they feed on the leaves in the canopy of the tree. But those are deciduous leaves that are tasty. I doubt that this beetle does anything other than dig into the bark of the tree and perhaps make galleries that eventually girdle the tree.
Huh.
So if you're going to use it, it would probably have to be injected into the trunk
or you'd have to do the syringe thing like you would do sometimes when people use beneficial nematodes to fight against pests like the vine borer. But it sounds to me like, you know, a lot of plants are falling out of favor in locations where they used to do real well with whatever you want to call it, climate change or global warming, and the introduction of all these imported nuisance pests. So it's time to start replanting with a different species. And yeah. I would go for something like low-growing junipers, which I've seen in a lot of dunes. And the fact that they're low to the ground makes them a lot easier to establish, makes them hardier against those real hurricane-like winds like Sandy that come along.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like good advice.
Well, I'm sorry. I wish it was more upbeat, but it sounds like you have a region that you can have a lot of good protective plantings holding those dunes in place. And that's really what you need to concentrate on, not specifically what it is.
Okay.
All right. Sorry, Craig. Good luck, man.
Appreciate your help.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will deliver workshops on beneficial insects and composting at the NOFA New Jersey Conference on January 30th and 31st at Brookdale Community College in Lincroft, New Jersey. Registration is still open and scholarships are available for beginning farmers. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with burning bushes, burning phone calls, and more. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Harvest Right. Harvest Right's home freeze dryer allows you to preserve your own freeze-dried food that can last 25 years. Meat, fruit, vegetables, and ice cream can be freeze-dried at home. More at harvestright.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. The popular landscape plant known as burning bush, amazingly red fall color. What do you do when your dwarf burning bush gets bigger than your house? We will also suggest a plant that may well have been the true burning bush of the Old Testament. That's a lot to get done. We better hop right back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Victoria, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Victoria. How are you?
I am well, thank you. In Dayton, Ohio.
What can we do for Victoria in Dayton?
I live in the city, and I have a very small fenced-in backyard, roughly 1,000 square feet. About 5 years ago, I put in a white pine, and it just grew beautifully, and I really like it. That's when I decided to turn my little backyard into a small pine grove, and I've added 8 small white pines about 9 feet apart.
Okay.
My goal eventually is to have a pine needle bed with no grass. So my question is, will the roots get deep enough to maybe hurt my water line since it is right in the city? And can I speed up the process by putting down pine straw on the grass?
Boy, it sounds like way too many trees for the area. How tall is the oldest tree now?
30 feet, maybe.
And do you have room for 9 50-foot tall trees back there?
Well, that's kind of my question. I'm thinking that I would probably have to cut the bottom branches up to where I could at least walk under them. I'm sure I'm going to have to thin some of them out.
Well, I don't think there's much danger to your water pipes. Pines aren't known for having invasive roots, but are you saying they're growing underneath power lines?
Yes, I have power lines from the alley to my house.
Well, you know, these are trees that at their mature height, I mean, they're 50 to 80 feet high. And when they grow naturally in the wild, they don't shade each other like this. There is more room in between them.
Okay.
There's a possibility that the tops of these trees will look okay because they're reaching up towards the sun. But the bottoms are going to be pretty much self-limiting. They're going to brown out pretty quickly as these trees get to a certain size. I think you got too many of them, especially if you're anywhere near the power lines.
Right, right.
So, you know, you planted 8 in an area, I'm thinking, that would probably max out with 3 trees very nicely.
Okay.
You don't need, like, the trees to drop their needles straight down and cover the lawn. Once your trees are, like, 10, 15 years old, 3 trees will produce enough pine needles to smother your lawn 6 inches deep every season.
Oh, that's good news. Okay.
So I think you have a little bit of overkill going on here. And because mm-hmm. you are in an urban area, you really want to look at these things judiciously. Because, again,
right.
we're probably at a state right now where you can take down some of the smaller ones without hiring help.
Right, yes. They were just saplings when I put them in. None of them have reached 3.5 feet yet.
Good, good. So right away I would get rid of any that are going to impact the power lines because, you know,
okay.
what happens if you get sick or you, like me, you break your rotator cuff and you can't do any pruning for 2 years. And if you realize if they just get out of control and grow wild, it costs thousands of dollars to remove each one.
Right, yeah.
You know, if you had told me what your plan was earlier, I would have said to plant a lot of low-growing juniper and just let that cover the lawn.
Yeah.
But you want to walk in between these trees on a carpet mm-hmm. of pine mulch, right?
Right, yes.
I'm thinking 3 trees, 4 maximum. The more distance between them, the more light that can get to the each tree, the nicer they're going to look. 8 trees look
right.
together are going to look like one of these places you drive past where you wonder, did somebody spill something in there?
Okay.
You have to be patient. It'll, you know, once you get 3 or 4 trees going, you let them mature. I have a single white pine in my front yard, and it drops an impossible number
really?
Of needles every, oh yeah, just a 4 times what you would expect a single tree to produce while still looking beautifully green.
Oh, okay.
No, they're like some cats that I've had. These things are massive shedders, you know.
Yeah, I've got it. But no hairball, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. No, I don't want to see a white pine hairball. That would be ugly.
Okay.
All right, good luck, Victoria.
Well, thank you so much for your help. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com. and by Harvest Right. Harvest Right's home freeze dryer allows you to preserve your own freeze-dried food that can last 25 years. Meat, fruit, vegetables, and ice cream can be freeze-dried at home. More at harvestright.com.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Thaddeus, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Yeah, thank you very much for taking the call. Listen, I got two or three questions. The main one is I'd like to know where I can purchase a Siberian spruce.
Where are you, Thad?
I'm in the Pocono Mountains, up in Canadensis.
In situations like yours, what I always recommend is you go around to a couple of your big local independent garden centers, not big box stores.
Okay, I'll do that. Now, another question is, help me out with this. My fruit trees are not blossoming, not blooming. It doesn't have a blossom the last 3 years.
Hmm.
I tried, I put some fertilizer in. Maybe I got the wrong type, but yes, I know 2 or 3 years ago we had a problem with the bees because of the gypsy moths, and they sprayed the area, and the bees wasn't coming around.
No.
Okay.
Totally incorrect. Sure. But I'll tell you right away that when they do the aerial spray programs for the gypsy moth, they're spraying the old original form of BT, which has no effect on bees.
Okay. So that question.
Okay. Well, wait a minute, Thad. What kind of fruit?
The pear trees and the apple trees. I know 3 years ago I had blossoms on the pears. And I had a pear. The first year, it was 6 pear trees, and it has fruit. But after that gypsy moth infestation, and I sprayed around the house, I guess I didn't get any blossoms at all.
What did you spray?
I got something from Home Depot. I'm not sure what it was.
Okay, you can't do that, though. If you don't know what you're doing, it's better not to do anything.
Well, I had to spray because it's so the whole area killed all them.
Yes, but there are organic sprays, again, like BT, that you can get that aren't going to harm your bee populations. You can't just pick up a gun and start shooting.
No, I hear what you're saying.
Now, do the trees get good sun?
Yes.
And are they planted in any kind of a lawn or near any area where herbicides are used?
No. They're planted in my backyard where there's space for the trees to have sun. I have a lot of trees. But I got to single out so they can get direct sunlight.
Good, good, good. You're saying these trees do get 8 hours of sunlight a day?
Yes.
Do you prune them?
No.
Okay. Are you feeding these trees?
I got some fruit fertilizer I put down. I forget which one I got, but two, because one is for an apple tree and the pear trees. I try to mix them together. Or I try to use it in exchange, you know. I didn't know, but it was for fruit trees. I think it would help.
Okay. There's no fertilizer that's specific to apples as opposed to pears or peaches.
Well, I thought maybe the alkaline, it might have been too much acid in the ground or something.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think you're swinging blind here, Thad. Why don't you take a soil sample? The local soil lab is at Penn State University, but you can have your soil tested through your local state extension office in the Poconos. Call them up, and they'll either send you out a test kit or you can pick one up. You'll fill it with the soil and send it back to them. I have a feeling that there is something wrong with your soil, but it's probably from something that you've put down. So
it's mainly sand. I bought the land 20 years ago, and they put all that sand because there was a lot of rocks.
Okay.
And I got dirt on it, but there was plenty of sand, but there's rocks under that sand.
Okay. That's good for drainage. Now, have you been adding compost to give these trees any organic matter?
I went and got Miracle-Gro.
Okay. Now, see what's... Yeah, no, it's all your fault. What's happening... See, when you have sandy soil, there's no nutrients in the soil, and the soil can't really hold nutrients. You know, think of pouring water through sand. So your Miracle-Gro is a concentrated salt-based chemical fertilizer. It's just washing away and harming the water supplies in your region. There's no way it can do anything for your trees. What you need to do is find a good local source of bulk organic compost. get a big load of rich black compost delivered and use that to mulch your entire backyard around these trees. Don't touch the trunk of the tree, but put 2 inches of compost down all around them. And okay. No more chemicals, no more sprays.
But I'm going to take all the grass out, then put that compost down.
Yes, very good.
Okay.
All right, but Thad.
Thank you very much. You have a great day.
All right, Thad. You take care and good luck, sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Dwarf burning bush is not one of Snow White's 7. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please get us started with this week's question.
Sure, Mike. Teddy from Harlan County, Kentucky writes, I have what they call a dwarf burning bush, and if it's a dwarf, I would hate to see its big brother. It's over 6 feet tall and blocking my window and the view from my porch. What is the best time to trim my big dwarf burning bush? It has flat branches and red berries. It's beautiful in the fall and early winter, and I don't want to do anything to hurt it.
Well, one of the very first articles I found when I did my original research on this question said that many people are shocked to find their dwarf burning bush grow taller than they are, and explained the dwarf, in this case, referred to the size of the leaves and not the actual plant.
That would make sense in terms of Teddy's experience, if not real horticultural sense.
But try as I might, I could not find that article again to save my life. But I did find lots of information about a variety of burning bush known as compactus or compacta to indicate that it is compact, meaning it would be a true dwarf variety.
But this dwarf is 6 feet tall.
And that's still within the so-called final height of 6 to 8, maybe 10 feet tall for this dwarf. See, dwarf doesn't actually mean small, just smaller than the standard variety. And the standard here gets so big it's sometimes used as a screening plant or planted in rows to make a giant wall. A couple of my dwarf peach trees would be over 12 foot tall by now if I didn't prune out the tallest branches every year. But the standard ones grow twice that tall and twice that fast.
So, do you know when and how to prune it? Because we also have an email from Reed in Forest Lake, Minnesota, who writes, how much can I prune my burning bush? It is 20 years old and out of control. If I prune 18 inches, how much will grow back this season?
Well, basically, this is a deciduous shrub, one that loses its leaves every winter. And people who want to keep it manageable prune it back at the end of winter, early spring, every year. And that every year part is really important. You're always going to get better results if you give your plants an annual haircut, as opposed to waiting until they've grown out of control.
But pruning at that time of year would limit the number of flowers, and Teddy in Kentucky specifically mentions that he likes the berries.
Right. The flowers are, quote, insignificant, meaning that they aren't much to look at. Very much like the flowers on my blue holly. You really have to look to see them. But later in the season, every one of those flowers has a chance to become a fruit. And they all did on my holly this year. Some years I only get a couple of berries, but this winter is out of control. We had a very holly Christmas.
And a blue holly, so blueberries?
Red. Supposedly the leaves are some kind of blue. I don't know. Anyway, the Minnesota listener can prune his shrub back by a third. 18 inches might actually be conservative, depending on the actual size of the plant. But he should resist the temptation to do more than a third and plan to prune a little bit every year from now on. And in Minnesota, you want to wait until all chance of frost is gone. No, quote, late winter pruning for them. Winter in Minnesota can come back and say hello to you the first week of June.
And what about Kentucky?
Well, if he has the compacta, the true dwarf burning bush, it's naturally a 6 to 8 foot plant that's grown for its incredible fiery red fall color. If he needs it to be some kind of extreme bonsai, he should just replace it. Otherwise, he should be able to keep it a nice tidy 5 feet with some annual pruning. But if he wants to max out the berries, he should move it to a bigger spot. you know, the less pruning you do, the more berries you get.
So this shrub got its common name for having bright red leaves. Could it possibly be the burning bush of the Bible?
No, because it's not native to anywhere near the Holy Land. But some plant archaeologists do postulate that the burning bush of the Bible could well have been a plant in the genus Dictamanus, which even sounds like a book of the Old Testament. It is native to that part of the world, and it produces so much volatile aromatic oil that it can combust near a heat source or even just on a hot and sunny day. To quote my gigantic plant book, my big reference, the bush is engulfed in flame, but so briefly that it is not damaged. Its other common name is the gas plant.
You're making this up.
I'm not that clever. The plant was a popular symbol for 16th century French Huguenots, accompanied by the motto, I am burned but not consumed. The gas plant is said to be very difficult to establish, but if you can get one growing, it's hardy all the way down to zone 3. That means you could theoretically grow the real burning bush in Minnesota. Well, that sure was some interesting information about bushes that are burning now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening I can't say any of the obvious things here, so I'll just say, hey, look over there, and add that we are out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore, at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location, especially if you think we don't need it. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where I'll bet you'll find the answers to all of those questions you were going to email us about, as well as audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Diana Martinez. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Lauren Elkins keep our website burning bright. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. And if I say anything about her height, she'll make me sound like Alvin and the Chipmunks. Too Tall Al Banks is our editor. I'm your host, burning hot Mike McGrath, saying it's a good thing that I am not consumed so that I can see you again next week. Can you grow mistletoe as a cash crop? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss the perplexity of planting this parasite to perhaps peddle prodigiously to pagans and pilgrims, plus your fabulous phone calls.